Hey everybody, welcome to the Daily Friend Wednesday edition. This is your Daily Friend briefing, a lunchtime briefing. Everything you need to know in the world of news, opinion and analysis. Brought to you, of course, by our writers and analysts here at the Daily Friend. You can find our writing, analysis and thoughts, if you will, on the Daily Friend website. That's dailyfriend.co.za. Remember to support our work. You can do that by becoming a friend of the IRR. How do you do that, you ask? Well, you can SMS your name to 32823 or alternatively find us online at irr.org.za. Remember that SMS will cost you R1 and terms and conditions do apply. How about you pledge $90 a month towards our work? It is your funds that get us into the battle of ideas. I am joined today by a really special panel, voices who I think you haven't heard in a while, including a one Marius Ruert, who I'm looking across the table at. Marius, how are you doing?
Good morning, Sikhde.
Hello, hello. And Marius Ruert, of course, is the head of campaigns here, and of course a writer and analyst, a very capable one. And I'm sure you guys will be looking forward to some of his pieces on the Daily Friend website. I am also joined by the IRR chief economist, Mr. Ian Cruickshanks. Monsieur Cruickshanks, how are you, sir?
I'm very well. On this, what can say is only a gorgeous winter day. Winter like this is survivable. Would that it could just spread through the economy.
Absolutely. It is a very mild winter and it's a very mild economy, isn't it? One which is not growing and worse yet, I fear, is hemorrhaging investment. And you're going to tell us about the equity market, which saw a loss again this week? Or
yes, certainly. This is the view that outsiders have of South Africa. What are they doing? They're pummeling the rand to start off with. 15 rands to the dollar. Well, that's the worst it's been for several months now. In addition to that, many of them are taking their investments from South Africa. They're saying, sell. We don't want you anymore. Give us what we've got left and we'll take it away. To what extent is this? Well, last week alone, there was 15 billion net outflow, net sales of equities and bonds of South African origin taken away by foreigners, and what they've said is we're not coming back. How does that add up? Is it a big amount? Yes. Year to date, it's 82 billion up to the end of last week, net outflow. Now, does it matter? I'm darn sure it does. The Minister of Finance always says when he gives the budget in February, don't worry about the deficit. This deficit now rushing towards 6%, maybe higher, which is way into danger territory. It'll be offset by foreign portfolio inflows. Inflows, we've got an outflow. Normally, at this time of the year, you would have seen anything from 30 to 40 billion inflow going to a total of 60 or so billion expected for the year as a whole. Now it's going in the opposite direction. There you have the international view of South Africa as an investment destination. It's looked on as being very unattractive.
Maurice, there is a very sad tale being told here. Ian is literally giving us in very vivid numbers, a breakdown of just how much of a cluster mess, as I always say.
I think you're getting the word wrong.
you know, the economy is. Now, let's set it out for the listener a bit. We have a new president, or relatively new now president. Upon taking up the presidency, what did he do? He went on this world tour to all the investor conferences around the world. There's this wave of so-called Ramaphoria. Oh, we're going to bring in the investment. If you remember, he had that little trip to the Saudis also where he said, yeah, we're going to bring in all this investment. It's going to be lovely. Ian is now quite ably breaking down the fact that actually investment is leaving our shores. Marius? We have this conversation quite a lot, and I want you to set it out for us again. It's the ideology, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. I mean, President Cyril Ramaphosa can go to wherever he likes, and he can get investors to promise him trillions of rands, but nobody's going to put the money into South Africa if the policies don't change, and policies won't change because of the ideology that is in the ANC. I mean, no investor will invest in a country where there's SOE where the government is putting in 60 billion rand. That seems like on a whim almost. Mm. And where your property rights aren't secure, where something like NHI is about to be implemented. And I mean, as I was saying to somebody the other day, NHI, it's so unworkable and unaffordable, yet we're still going ahead with it. Shows you so the ideology is just, I mean, NHI is a noble idea in practice, but having a single payer with no medical aids, apparently only two countries in the world do it, and that's Canada and Cuba. And Cuba is a communist totalitarian state, and Canada is much richer than we are, and they can afford it. We can't afford that kind of thing.
Well, also, just very briefly, to the listener, NHI stands for the National Health Insurance. It's the proposed policy by the ANC, which essentially would see the nationalization of the healthcare sector, essentially, run by a massive SOE called the NHI, which will then decide for you, the consumer of a healthcare product, where you consume it, how you consume it, and how much you can consume of that product. I mean, there have already been threats, for example, of rationing out medical specialists, you know, how often you can see them. It's a completely asinine policy proposal, but it's one which is being proposed by politicians because, as we say, it's the ideology stupid, as the, here are people who believe that they must control every all aspects of your life, from your pension fund to your healthcare to your, you know, how you even look after your family. And we're saying, as classical liberals on the show, that that's actually not the approach you need. The approach you need is to one which recognizes the individual. And again, when I talk about individuals, really, we're a family society. So one which empowers the family and not the bureaucrats in Pretoria. Ian, I'm going to come back to you because I want to get us, I want the listener to get a strong sense of really the complete picture of how the economic outlook is panning out. Our last conversation saw us go through some numbers, which were beginning to point to why you were saying that the economic outlook overall is a negative one. Yeah. What are some of the other numbers that have been coming out? We've spoken about the RAND. We've spoken about the outflows. I think you mentioned the fact that 15 billion this last week has left in a single week, which is absolutely amazing. What else do you have for us?
Well, last night I went along to the 6 monthly results presentation of Nedbank, one of our major banks, and the CEO was at pains to say that what was needed was clear. But there's been no action. Nothing is happening. Nothing is getting done. And what is more, there's no backup of new plans to see that these do go ahead and that the economy gets some sort of activity, getting some sort of benefit, getting moving towards greater job creation. We're moving towards job destruction. How are we going to get spending in that? What we see is, you know, in our economy, over 60% of total economic activity is due to consumer spending. Well, if there are fewer people being paid, there's less money with which to boost consumer spending, nothing's going to happen. And Nedbank themselves said yesterday they're looking at a GDP growth rate of 0.5%. That is 0.5%, having come down from around 2% earlier this year. Now, that goes in with our own view. Mm-hmm. I think we're stuck at the moment. If there's no concrete change going to come about in between a zero and a no growth between a zero and low growth situation for the foreseeable future. And that's just what Mike Brown said yesterday. He saw that the possibility of a shrinking in the economy was a very real one.
You know, my concern as I listen to this is that there are South African families out there who are firstly unaware of the downward spiral, if I may quote a former Eskom CEO, of not only SOEs but the economy. Morris, I'm going to come back to you on this one because I really want us to flesh out. And by the way, we'll come back to some of the pieces that we have on the Daily Friend, and I'm quite confident that a lot of what we're discussing now will find its way onto the Daily Friend website. That's dailyfriend.co.za. And just at this point, let me also give a shout out to the Frederick Naumann Foundation for their support of this particular episode. Thanks, guys. We appreciate that. Marius, you know, we have a situation where, and I tweeted this morning, that all the bad policy, all the bad laws, the laws that essentially restrict and constrict the South African economy, are coming to a head. And one can almost, like a wounded sailor, you know, in the ocean, can see the shark sort of smelling the blood and circling around. You know, these economic headwinds. What should the average citizen be thinking about at the moment? And again, I know I'm throwing quite a Hail Mary pass at you on this one, but, you know, what are the top three things policy-wise? And I'll chip in on one, for example, on prescribed assets. Yes. And we've mentioned, actually, so maybe the top thing you think, you know, South Africans should be aware of in terms of bad policy heading their way.
Well, I think, firstly, ordinary South African should probably be going through their family tweets to see if they have any access to a foreign passport, perhaps.
We laugh, but hey, man, some of us are really doing that.
But it's a difficult one to talk about, but I think people need to be aware of what is coming our way. Unless there's a serious changes in the economy, which seem unlikely at the moment, they're going to be going to have even higher unemployment, higher rates of poverty. But like our senior colleague Franz Cronier always says, in times of crisis, that is often where things change for the better. We saw it in South Africa in apartheid at the end of the 1980s. Country was running out of money. Civil war was quite likely. And we actually turned the corner and we were a successful country for a while until we got... I mean, there were issues, of course, under Nelson Mandela and Thabo Mbeki, but things overall were going pretty well. Another country we can look at is India, who also ran out of money in 1991, and then they changed. They were always quite a socialist status country up until then. When they ran out of money, they embraced the free market, and they've actually become they're doing quite well. Their economy is growing, has been growing at quite a high rate for the last couple of years, and the poverty levels in that country are. Been reduced without a threat to democracy, but that has changed now recently since Narendra Modi and the BJP came into power. There has been a rise in Hindu nationalism, which is a bit of a problem. But overall, the Indian economy has been doing very well over the last 30 odd years because of the free market.
And just before I come to you, Ian, sorry about that. I just wanted to segue back to some of the pieces we have on the Daily Friend, which I think readers should be going through and being aware of. I mean, there's some great. I'll go through the opinion pieces that I've sort of seen. You know, our colleague Sarah Gunn, who is the chief editor of the Daily Friend, she wrote a piece about the unionism is essentially in this country, with a zooming in on the South African Municipal Workers Union. And if you remember what happened in the last week. And we've discussed it on the show with Gabriel, if you remember that. The South African Municipal Workers Union, or SAMU, literally went on a complete, utter and reckless rampage in the streets of Tshwane, that's Pretoria, you know, from trashing the streets to, stealing state vehicles and, you know, doing wheelies and all sorts of things in the town with them, and a complete breakdown in the rule of law. So if you want to see what her piece is on this, just go to dailyfriend.co.za. There's also a lovely piece by John Kane Berman, who's our very able writer and analyst, policy fellow here at the IRR, where he looks at the threat again of expropriation without compensation. Now, as I said to Morris, there's a policy proposal that I think you guys need to be aware of that are coming your way. Expropriation without compensation is not off the table. It's back, especially when you consider the land panel's recent report. That's the panel that was advising the president. We've spoken already about prescribed assets, which is the state essentially looking to come after your pensions. These are all policy proposals that are heading your way. And if you read the dailyfriend.co.za, you'll be very able, you'll be made aware of the threats that they pose to you. So remember, go to the dailyfriendwebsite.co.za. Ian, I'm going to come back to you as we sort of look towards last gasps and last thoughts on issues. Morris has set out quite clearly how ideology plays a very important factor in all of this, but it's all coming to a head now, isn't it?
It is, and what is interesting is reality. This dose of reality is leading to some change in serious thoughts. I asked last night at Nedbank, the CEO. I said, "There's a threat, an implied threat by the bankers' union." 70,000 members it has, and they're normally very well controlled and very low key. So I said, what are the chances that they actually go ahead with a strike that is mooted to take place in another month's time? And he said, they're not going to have a strike, the rules say they shouldn't, until there has been some conference between the employers and the employees. They haven't approached them yet, the employees have not approached them, and maybe it's this concern that jobs are more important. Having a job is more important than the threat of a strike and some days off work. But what I'd like to also mention, though, is the global environment. There's some signals coming through that we cannot ignore. For instance, the gold price, always the last safe haven, has just reached a six-year high. The highest in 6 years high since 1913. Yes, it was 1913. We now 1919. I beg your pardon. I was out. Machine, yeah. I was out by a mere century. Okay, 2013 to 2019. Why is that? Because of concern of the global environment and the rush of funds to safe havens. What does it mean for us? We're not a safe haven. We're the worst haven. And I think it means just backs up the view that we're going to see a taking out of capital. And lastly, but not least, the oil price, always an early indicator or a good indicator of overall economic activity, has fallen 20% since its recent high. Why? Because it's expected there's going to be less industrial activity, less overall workability, and I think that that's just saying, beware, the global environment is becoming more unfriendly, just as our own internal one is. We're getting a double whammy on the wrong side now. Look after your job. Cut your coat according to your means. Don't be extravagant. That's the message right now.
And Ian, you know, one of the interesting things, just sorry, because you raised the issue of the banking community. You know, I read a piece this week basically citing how even the bank stocks are now beginning to take a hit with all the, you know, the succession of bad news that's come out. I mean, the bank stocks, I'm sort of reading here, has dropped about 15% since the president actually pledged a relentless focus on growth in his State of the Nation address. No one is immune to the slide.
Absolutely not. In the days of high inflation and high interest rates and high profits coming in the financial sector, we got used to the fact that you'd get a minimum of 20% growth in profits per annum. This year they proudly said, we've come out on the positive side. Our net profit is 2.3% up. 2.3, when we were used to 20% in those high inflation days. There's a sign that the best managed, tightest managed organizations are really struggling.
Absolutely. Maurice, final thoughts.
Well, we were just talking about the Daily Friend earlier, and there's a very good article by Michael Morris, our head of media, and he's talking about a speech that was given by Ken Andrew as an MP for the Democratic Party in 2000. In that speech, he laid out what the government needs to do to get South Africa on a path where we have high levels of employment, high levels of growth, and so on. And it's very depressing because everything he puts out is exactly what we still need now.
Absolutely.
And the government, I mean, apart from maybe some reforms in the 2000s, we've gone backwards by quite a lot since 2009. And everything that Ken Andrew laid out in 2000 is exactly what still needs to be done in this country. And if we don't see these reforms, we'll talk about 30% unemployment as sort of a golden age if we're not careful.
Yeah, Maurice, just I want to pick your brain very quickly before we wrap this up. Really, I'm going to again throw another Hail Mary pass at you. But over this week, we had a journalist, Ferrell Hafaji, write a piece. Which basically just extols her victimhood as to how she's
look,
being
look, I'm not going to be the biggest person or the most sympathetic person to Ferrell because she was also spoke about harassing people and her and one of her colleagues also basically doxed me and came into my office.
And that's exactly why I went to you on this one.
Which made me lose my last job, which is fine. I mean, I've spoken about this on other platforms. And
But let me frame it. Hang on, let me frame it because over here, it speaks to what we liberals hold quite sacrosanct, which is the freedom of speech, and how, you know, journalists in this country don't actually take it seriously, especially when it's other people who are on the receiving end of, you know, the abuse and really the not respecting, rather, of other people's freedom of speech. Journalists in this country have a bit of a record of actually being pro limiting other people's free speech, and you've been a victim of that.
Yeah, I mean, probably most listeners know what happened with the whole Shelley Garland saga a couple of years ago. And as I say, I mean, I could have handled myself better in that whole issue, but I'd have to say this bleating from people like Ferrell Hafaji, it does stick a bit in the craw, seeing as the way they carried on when I was involved in that. And also another thing with Ferrell and a number of other journalists, when Julius Malema first came to prominence, people fawned over him. And when he became leader of the EFF, everyone was like, oh, he's going to shake up the scene. Nobody thought he's a misogynist, the things he said about Kwesi. He's a racist, the things he said about white people initially. He's corrupt.
And Indian South Africans.
No, but remember, he started with whites. And then people like, oh, no, you know, he's shaking up. He's changing, like, you know, he's saying things we need to say. When he starts going for Indian people, then saying he's a big racist. You know, so, but I mean, I think it's Martin Niemöller from who said when the Nazis first came for these guys, I didn't say anything. When the Nazis first came for these guys, I didn't say anything. When they came for me, there wasn't anybody to say anything about. I mean, not that the EFF are Nazis, but I think there are parallels to draw. And then also with Julius Malema, we saw when on point construction. I mean, it's pretty clear that he was involved in corrupt dealings and I don't want to say theft, but perhaps. And we've seen what happened with VBS and what have you. So, I mean, all these people who fawned over Julius Malema in the beginning, it's actually ridiculous. We knew what he was. And same, actually, another issue with the journalists. Remember I kicked out, I think the guy's name's Jonah Fisher.
Yeah.
The BBC journalist.
Yeah.
And I mean, he treated him appallingly. Yeah. And that was when he was still in the ANC Youth League, before he even became a member of the EFF. And everyone's like, oh, old Julius, he's such a funny guy. He's shaking things up. Mm. But it was clear what he was. Julius Malema never hid what he was. Mm. And the fact that we have him now, and this rhetoric that's also now infected the ANC, partly because of Malema, is because journalists and much of the media in South Africa gave him a free pass with almost everything.
Absolutely. And I really wanted to raise this because, again, guys, there is a piece on the Daily Friend. Just look for social media, a threat in inverted commas to free expression. And you can read what, you know, some of the analysis we've been drawing on this, because it is a real threat. Guys, let me wrap it up over here. We've reached our sort of threshold in time. And let me thank you, the listener. You know, we really appreciate your comments, your feedback for these lunchtime briefings. Remember, we come out every Monday, Wednesday and Friday at 12 p.m. for your lunchtime briefing by the Daily Friend team. Guys, thank you so much for listening. Remember to look out for our other shows that will be coming out this Friday. That is the actual YouTube show, the weekly roundup. Guys, thank you so much for listening. We will see you on Friday.